once we have settled our bodies into a position that our spine helps us to stay effortlessly upright so we are not holding on anywhere, then the question comes, what do we do with our mind now that our body is settled? And there is a mistaken belief that meditation is designed to calm the mind and that that is the goal, to have our mind become quiet. Unfortunately, our mind, like dogs and small children, when we tell it to be quiet, it just comes out back louder and sometimes bites us. So we are not shouting at our mind to be quiet or judging it if it's not. What we're doing is we're making ourselves into an ocean wave. And the thoughts come up, and we just let them go away. And we watch them come up, and we watch them go away. This, by the way, is Zen meditation. Other types of meditation that you may be familiar with take an object. Zen meditation does not. So we're just watching the thoughts come up and go away. And it could be that during this time of watching this, that we want to hang on to a thought and grab it and run with it and make it a full-length Technicolor movie with ourselves as the main actor in every scene. But instead, we're just going to let it go. So the body component of this is to let our body remind us that we are right here, right now, always in the present. Fortunately, our body is always in the present. It's never in the past or in the future. So it's right here. And we can just watch these thoughts come up and watch them go away. Come up and go away. Your hands, by the way, will be an early warning indicator of some tightening and some story following if you're chasing after a story. I might suggest that if you are sitting with your hands on your knees, that you try palm up. This will keep you from gripping your clothing or tightening your fists, and you will notice when that happens a little sooner. So for just the next several moments, we're just going to sit. Before we start on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, we will just sit and watch the thoughts come up and watch them go away. If your body becomes uncomfortable, please don't tough it out. Very carefully ask your body how it would like to sit. And please feel free to gently move if you need to. The greater part of our suffering in the world comes not so much from deliberate wickedness as from ignorance, heedlessness, thoughtlessness, and rashness. Very often, a single moment of mindfulness or wise reflection can prevent a far-reaching sequence of misery or guilt. By pausing before action, we will be able to seize that decisive but brief moment when mind has not yet settled upon a definitive course of action or a definite attitude, and allow the inner breaks of wisdom, self-control, and common sense a chance to operate. Acquiring the habit of slowing down will prove effective against rashness in words and deeds. When the supremacy of these habitual reactions, which are so often left unopposed and unquestioned, is regularly challenged, they will gradually lose their power. The purpose of meditation is not to get anywhere nor to get anything done. The purpose of meditation is to come home. Good morning. Thank you for that very settled start. Didn't that feel nice? Imagine if the whole world did that for 20 minutes every morning. My goodness, what a different world that would be. So we can do that. We can do this. We can come home to our body. The part that I will be teaching today will be the four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutra, one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha. And in case you're wondering about how the two halves of this teaching today fit together, it's like this, or like this, maybe. This is the teaching of the Buddha that has the most resonance with yoga, and many of the Buddha's teachings have that connection, but this is the one that has, so when you have a meditation and yoga workshop, This is the ideal one that you want to be teaching. This is heaven, as far as I'm concerned, is to be able to do the four foundations of mindfulness with a yoga teacher because they go so well together. So the idea in the four foundations of mindfulness in the Buddhist teaching is that there is a wisdom in the body, and the wisdom in the body can counteract the craziness that goes on in our heads. So the idea in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is that if we try to start with the mind to cure the mind, we're hosed. Because the mind has so many strategies, and it's been at them for decades, and it's really good at all of this. And so it can talk us into and out of everything. So the idea is that we come home to the body. So we'll take each of the four foundations in turn, and between those explanations, Barbara will do the yoga component that will go to that. So to bring alive that foundation in our bodies and to give us some opportunity to practice and experience that, which you don't necessarily need a room full of other people and a meditation and yoga instructor to do. What we're trying to offer here today is things that you can do wherever you find yourself throughout the day. The four foundations of mindfulness, just to give you a brief overview, and then we'll take up the first one. The four foundations of mindfulness start with the body, not with the mind. The mind is actually way down the path on this. And the idea is that if we can come home to the body, to remember that the body is always and forever in the present, as long as we have the body, that we can come home to that, and that's an antidote to the past and future that our mind tends to live in. So the first foundation of mindfulness is the body. The second foundation is what's called feelings, but not emotions. That's later. Feelings are simply pleasant, unpleasant, and unsteady or uncertain. That's the second foundation of mindfulness. There's quite a bit of power there because that's a really good place to stop the escalation of the feelings becoming humongous stories that cause suffering. So the second foundation of mindfulness is pretty short, but it's also the powerful place to notice just if we're having pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and just to stop the story right there. And we'll talk about how to do that. So in each of these, when I'm talking about the foundation, we will talk about how to use it to help the mind come back into the present and to not get way down the road with these stories, mostly of self-defense, blame, accusation, and 105 other things that we'll talk about. The list is actually 108. That we'll talk about how we get into these stories that then cause suffering. And those 108 are the third foundation of mindfulness. This is called states of mind, what we usually know as emotions. And these labels that we put on our emotions tend to stick. We tend to think they're permanent, and we tend to think that we are those. Like, I am angry, or he's an angry person, or she's an introvert. We tend to stick these, and then they forever stay on us or on the other person, and this causes all kinds of suffering. As Darlene Cohen, who did several of you know, did an enormous amount of work in the yoga and the meditation of working with pain in the body, says, she had this wonderful saying where she said, to label is to dismiss. So once we put that third foundation of mindfulness label on something, then we're locked into a story, and it's very hard to back down from that. So to notice what the label is, and then to use the first two foundations to get under it. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is typically called objects of mind, but what that means is, how did we get here? How did we get to this story that we have latched onto, that has taken up residence in our body, that allows us to divide the world into us and them? I'm right, you're wrong, I'm over here, you're over there, I'm good, you're bad, all this separation that we tend to get into. So the four foundations of mindfulness, the body, feelings, states of mind or emotions, and objects of mind, how we got into that place, can be done forward and backward. So this sequence that I'll be talking with you about today, I'll always, when we're in a foundation that's 2, 3, and 4, I'll always talk about how we can back that down into the body rather than continuing to hang on to these stories that make us miserable. So I'm going to present the four foundations in the 1 through 4 order, but the antidote is to come back down through them and to end up back down in the body. So this is the Buddha's teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness. The Satipatthana Sutra, the text I'm using today is the Heart of Buddhist Meditation. This contains the sutra and also a lot of commentary on the four foundations. We have a list that was on your chair of resources, both meditation and yoga resources today, and this sutra is listed on there. The Satipatthana Sutra, the first one, is on the list. And the Heart of Buddhist Meditation is the book that I'm using today. The Buddha's teaching was that true awakening in body and mind is presence, not analysis. So the first foundation of mindfulness is about presence in the body. This foundation has three parts to it. The first one is coming home to the breath. The Buddha's teaching is all about creation of space. He mentioned this several times in his Dharma talks, in the sutras, and the space that we can start with creating is right here in our chest. If we sit all day, we tend to begin to breathe vertically, but we're actually not arranged to do that. We're actually arranged to breathe this way. Our rib cage is hinged this way, and our lungs are not exactly circular, but they are three-dimensional. So to create some space, we can actually feel that if you put your hands right here on your rib cage and take a nice deep breath, and notice what happens to your hands. They go out, don't they? They don't go up and down. They go out. So there's a practical application of this. I would suggest that the next time that you are in traffic and someone cuts you off on the road, that you keep one hand on the wheel and you put the other hand right here and take a nice deep breath. And remind yourself that there is the capacity to create space, which is otherwise known as options and alternatives, right here in your chest. If you are standing in line at the grocery store and you are irritated that the checker is having what seems to be an hour-long conversation with her friend who is also in line with 29 items in the 15-item line, and you're getting irritated and you can't switch lines, I would suggest that instead of cursing out the checker and her friend or his friend in your mind, you put your hands right here and take a nice deep breath. First foundation of mindfulness is to return to the body and let it remind us that we can create space right here in the breath. The second part of the first foundation of mindfulness, so we are still in the body, is our posture. This has enormous utility in the other three foundations, which I'll come back to, because what our mind does is our mind takes us out of balance. We get a story going, and before we know it, we're living over here. The problem is we don't realize we're living over here, so I'm wondering why I'm upright and you're all tilted. This is a really awful position to be in, but we don't see the issue. So take yourself deliberately out of alignment. And imagine living like this. Well, except we do, actually. We have things, okay, you can come out, but I'm actually going to stay here. We have things in our lives that we avert from. And so we live like this. We have things in our lives that we want. And we live like this. It may not be that obvious, but it has a toll on our body. I carry my fear in my right leg. And I didn't know that until about 20 years ago. I'm 61 this year. And I spent 40 years of my life very subtly like this. And I didn't realize that until I took a yoga class. And the instructor kept saying, "Valerie, you're not aligned, you're not upright." And I was like, "Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am." So when we get to the yoga component of this first foundation of mindfulness, please notice that when Barbara has us align, notice if you agree with that. And notice then if you have been favoring, even very subtly, a particular posture. By the way, I'm also an extreme introvert, so I also have a habitual posture of this. Just a little bit. It's like, please don't stand in my space. But I've noticed this. I've noticed this when I'm talking to people, is that I will do this very subtly, but I will do this. And the antidote to this is the breath. So, and Barbara's already done this morning with inhale. So go ahead and take yourself out of alignment again. Okay. And you notice that you're like this. Okay. So a nice inhalation using the inflationary capability of the lungs, like a buoy in the ocean, to come back up to upright. So this is the practical application of the first foundation of mindfulness, is any time that we notice that our posture has been knocked off balance by something, or more usually by someone, to deliberately use the breath to come back to upright. It doesn't necessarily fix the situation. I get that. It doesn't. This is not a cure-all. What it does is gives you more options, gives us more options for how we might deal with it. Trying to consider options when we're off balance and back here or up here, the field of vision really closes down. So even if we're in a tough situation, if we can remember to just let the buoyancy of the breath bring us back upright, that's all we need to do, is just a nice in-breath. Just the breath to find that alignment. The third part of this first foundation of mindfulness is the antidote to believing I am fill in the blank. I am angry. I am introverted. I am, I am, I am, I am, I am. So now I'm going to prove to you that you're not that. Okay, you, actually your body's going to prove to you that you're not that. So bring to mind some recent incident that was a difficulty, or maybe there was an argument with somebody or a missed expectation or something like that. That disappointment or that anger took up residence somewhere in your body. As long as we have a body, all thoughts have a bodily component and we can find them. So think of that incident and find the place in your body where that incident has taken up residence and put one hand, put your right hand there. We're not trying to fix it. We're just acknowledging that that's where that incident landed in our body. Maybe that place is tight, but we're not here to fix it. We're just here to be with it and identify it. Now take the other hand and put it on a part of your body that is not particularly affected by that incident. It might be your nose. It might be your toes. I don't know. But find a place in your body that is not affected by that incident that has come to roost under the right hand. So there's the proof right there in your body that you are not that incident. You are not the emotion you have associated with that incident. So to be able to say, I am angry, actually isn't true. It's not true, and the left hand proves it. So this is very helpful when especially something jarring and unexpected comes up. We'll feel it in our body. If you can develop the habit, don't worry how it looks, of putting one hand where that point really came home and landed, and then put the other hand on some place that isn't particularly affected by that. And that will prevent you from saying, I am that. The problem with I am that is that it's 100%. I am that. My entire being is irritated with you. My entire being is upset with myself. I am, I am, I am. If we can stop that right there and realize that this is not the case, we are not that, then again we have the opportunity to have some options. Now, I do want to say that there are some cases where the only place you can find that is not affected by the situation might be your hair. If that is the case, I would like to suggest to you, you might be dealing with PTSD or some other situation which meditation and yoga can help to alleviate the symptoms, but there is some other intervention indicated in that case. So meditation and yoga is not a cure-all for these kinds of things, but what it can help us do is back off the idea that we are that. And when we say we are that, then we are out of options. So this first foundation of mindfulness is the breath, a reminder that we have spaciousness right here in our chest, and we can come home to that spaciousness. Every time, nice deep breath. When we get scared or anxious or angry, we tend to breathe vertically, and we're actually not built that way. We're built this way. So to take this nice deep breath and remind ourselves to notice if the upset has knocked us off balance a little bit. When we are knocked off balance, the options become reduced. We can't see clearly. So to use that breath to come back upright and then see where we are. And finally, to realize that we are not that, that upset has taken up residence somewhere in our body. But there's another part that is not particularly affected with that. So let's put all of this together at the end of the first foundation of mindfulness. Find that place again where the upset took hold. And now take the posture that that upset wants to put you in. So what posture does that suggest? And over-exaggerate that posture. Stay there in that posture and notice what else is tightening up to allow you to stay in that posture that upset put you in. Notice how the upset is expanding beyond the right hand because of the effort of your body to keep you in that posture. Now, using the buoyancy of the breath, just bring yourself back up to an easeful upright. This does not deny that there was hurt or disappointment. We're not denying any of this. We are creating space for alternatives to arise. So the right hand now on that difficult spot, the left hand on the non-affected spot, but we're going to stay in uprightness here. This does not mean holding on. This means being aware if we're coming into an unbalanced posture and using the breath to come back upright. And now just let the right and left hands communicate. I know this sounds a bit squishy, but I think your hands will kind of get the idea. That the left hand is offering the idea that you are not that 100% that the right hand has. And the right hand can take some ease from the left hand that there is, in fact, a part of the body that is not clenched by this upset incident. So we're going to take just a few moments here of just quiet. You can leave your hands there until it becomes uncomfortable. Please don't keep them there if it's uncomfortable. But imagine that they are still there. And watch your posture and your breath. And see if you can use both to just stay in uprightness, even with the upset. Even with the upset. Notice if you begin to collapse into a posture and use your breath to come back up. Notice how insidiously your body or your mind may want your body to go back to that posture that upset created for you. And without judgment, just use the in-breath, the buoyancy of the in-breath, to just bring yourself back upright. Breathe into both parts of your body, under the right and the left hand. It's the warmth of the breath, not to fix, just to bring awareness. If you find that you cannot breathe into the space in the right hand, it's okay. See if you can breathe into the space around that hand. Using the breath to reorient the posture, to remind us that we are not that. We tend to over-identify with our stories until they become us and then they eat us. There have been endless studies in science and medicine on the nature of pain. One of the most interesting has found that almost 80% or up to 80% of the pain we feel from an injury or an illness is due to everything that we're doing around the site of that illness or injury to wall it off and to get away from it. This is very interesting. Up to 80% of our pain with an illness or an injury is due to what we do around it to get away from it. So when I said to, if you can't breathe into that hand, to breathe into the area around the hand, this is very important to make sure that if we have a physical or an emotional injury or an illness, that we take these steps and use the rest of our body so that it doesn't consume us and devour us. To realize that yes, this hurts. It does. And we will not let that take over the rest of our body. We will keep the rest of the body spacious with the breath, the posture, and remembering that we are not 100% that upsetting situation. Welcome back. Well, finally, now we're going to get to emotions. This is the third foundation of mindfulness. Usually we call these feelings, but as we saw before, the second foundation is feelings, just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Now in what's called states of mind, we get into the actual emotions, or not actual, as it turns out, in many cases. Unfortunately, this is where we tend to enter the movie, is here at the emotion stage. I'm angry, I'm upset, I'm this, I'm that, I'm whatever. And we tend to come in at this stage, and by this stage, the escalation into the story that makes us right and other people wrong, et cetera, is way down the road to being finished. Way down the road. And therefore, it's really hard to reel it in at this point in the emotions place. So what are these emotions? Well, classically in Buddhism, there are 108 of them. And those of you who keep coming to my classes here at the Sacramento Dharma Center are going to say, Valerie, you hand out this list every time. And the answer is, yes, I do, because this is the root of suffering right here. So we teach Buddhism. Buddhism is about suffering. Here's the list. Yeah. Pick your favorites. Only two or three, please. It's hard to choose. Yeah. So here we are. These are traditionally known in Buddhism as the kleshas, K-L-E-S-A-S, or S-A, pluralizing it as English would. And the usual translation of this is defilements, but the actual Sanskrit translation on this is distorted trace. That's the root translation. Distorted trace is the root translation of this, which is very interesting, which basically says that from the get-go, these are wrong. They're distorted from the beginning. These are not correct. And this is where things really begin to get problematic and hard to undo, which is why I was so emphatic in the first two stages, the first two foundations of mindfulness, is if we can catch our reaction there in those first two, it's much easier to back it out to the body, to stay upright. Once we get into the kleshas, we're in a swamp, sort of our emotions. And the most difficult part of this to undo is that if we don't have this right hand, left hand practice that I took us through earlier, we are very inclined to say, I am one of these 108. Pick one. Okay? I am, let's go with anger for just a moment. Okay? I am angry. Then 100% of us is angry, right? Because we're saying, I am, tatsat, I am that. So I am angry, and then a bunch of stuff kicks in. When we become that, then we cling to that, and we stay that. We can't see any alternatives, because 100% of ourselves is filled up with one of these 108 things on this sheet. And the story begins to escalate. We'll get to the story in the fourth foundation of mindfulness in about an hour. But right now, in the third foundation of mindfulness, this is where we stick the label on. And the problem with this is that we often stick it on with permanent glue. We cement it on. We want it there. Because if I have labeled you as something on this sheet, then I know exactly how to respond to you, and I don't have to learn another way to do it, and I don't have to see if you change. I know how to deal with you. As Darlene Cohen said, to label is to dismiss. So we get locked into these labels of these emotions, both for ourselves and for other people. Let me tell you mine, okay? I am an off-the-scale introvert. I think I mentioned this already. And that label has done not only not me, but not other people any good at all, right? This is good luck getting stuck with the label of introvert in a society that expects and rewards extroversion. It's really hard to be an introvert in modern American society. It's very hard because all the pull and all the expectations are the other way. To be social, to be friendly, to go to parties, to mingle. It's like, I just go, no, no. And my posture really does begin to go like this. So our labels, these labels are tragic, really, because they set up so much of our suffering. Here's what our author says about labels. the labels of these that we slap onto things. Owing to a rash or habitual limiting, labeling, misjudging, and mishandling of things, important sources of knowledge often remain closed. To label is to dismiss. Once we've got the label, we don't have to look anywhere else. Important sources of knowledge often remain closed. Normally, we are not concerned with the disinterested knowledge of things as they truly are, but with handling and judging them. We tack labels onto things from which our physical and mental universe are formed, and from these labels we generally live, and that determines our actions and our reactions. So once we are able to stick one of these labels on ourselves or on somebody, then we kind of are on autopilot, is basically what this is saying here. And this causes a tremendous amount of suffering, not the least of which is because we don't get an opportunity to see things change. And we may not notice that that angry person, just the person we labeled as the angry person, just lost a very important person in their life, and they're not angry anymore, they're grieving, for example. But because we've stuck the angry label on them, we can't see that they are grieving and to offer compassion and support. And why would we do that anyway? Because they're just angry. Except they're not. They're not. And it also doesn't help to be able to see changes in ourselves. Being an introvert, talking in front of people scared the living daylights out of me for many, many, many years, until I had quite a bit of wonderful training about how to be able to be in a group and not freak out. While that label, I suppose, of introvert still applies to me, a lot of the things that you might think of as baggage that comes along with it and the baggage that I had doesn't apply to me anymore. It's true that after today, I will go home and sleep for 2 days. and that's okay, because that's how I take care of myself. But I'm, it's wonderful to be here, and I'm not feeling any, aversion or anything about being with this many people. So this is an important one to know, because this is where we usually come in, is on this one. We come in with the label, and then we stick to it, and then we stick to the story. And this causes an enormous amount of suffering. So a couple things I'd like to say specifically about anger from a neurological study standpoint. The neuroscience on anger is that when they take MRIs or whatever those scans are, brain scans basically, of people in different emotion states, and they tell somebody a story or just ask them to imagine the last time that they were angry, the anger center, whatever it is in the brain, is never the first one that lights up. So the first thing to know is that anger is never the first emotion. There's always something before it, and it's usually fear or sadness. And we paper that over with anger because fear and sadness are not socially acceptable. And they're also a lot harder to deal with. We actually have to look inside at the fear and the sadness rather than, if I'm angry, I can blame you. Because you didn't meet my expectations, you disappointed me. There's a huge list on this. But anger is a very interesting one, because anger is never the first one that lights up in the brain. Something else does. So it's interesting to get under that. My teacher, Ed Brown, gave me a wonderful exercise many, many, many years ago, where he said, whenever you're tempted to say I'm angry, instead say I'm sad. And, oh man, did that work. It really did. And now it's kind of almost automatic that if I feel a bit of anger coming forward, and it tends to come from right down in here, I immediately say I'm sad. And then it's much easier to deal with that, of what is this sadness that's coming up. And it also prevents me from, not unkind things coming out of my mouth, from unkind actions coming out of my body, to realize that I am coming from sadness when I'm angry. And it's helpful. So I would encourage you to investigate. We're not going to do that this afternoon, but to investigate what is your first emotion before the anger. It's one of the other 107 on the list. So please investigate and see what that might be. The other practice that I would encourage you to take up is to get the I out of the sentence where it says, when we say, I'm angry. Well, remember the left hand in the exercises from this morning? The left hand was on a part of our body that was not particularly affected by the story. The left hand is the one that proves that we're not the emotion that we're feeling, because the left hand is on a place that isn't particularly affected by that. And so it's not true to say, I am angry. That's not true. Or any of the other 107 that are on there. It's not true, because if you want to go with defining yourself as your body, which is, you know, it's okay, you know, it's a good place to start, and then move on from there. But your body has just proven to you that you are not that. So it's helpful, instead of saying, I am one of these 108, to say something like, oh, that's arising, or I notice sadness, or something that acknowledges that this is coming up, but that it's not you. Okay, what works for me is to say, I notice this arising, and then I go actually immediately go to the hand thing. Okay, I recognize it by putting my hand wherever that is, and then also noticing that there's another part that isn't affected by that. But it's helpful to have some space to be able to say, I noticed that, so I'm not asking you to bury it. I'm not asking you to stuff it. I am asking you to notice it, but to not be it. And this gives some space for some possibilities to come in. And one of the possibilities is then to back it down into the second and the first foundation of mindfulness. So we're going to do that right now. So pick one from the list, just one. As Clem says, it's hard to pick, but but pick one, or, you know, pick your favorite one, or the one you like to go to on there. And then, even if you're not feeling this right at the moment, just come along for the sake of the exercise so that you can see how this happens. And instead of saying, I am introverted, or whatever your pick is on there, say that you're noticing it, that you notice it arising. So maybe you remember a recent incident where it did. If you can remember a recent incident where it actually did come up, just notice that and just say, oh, I notice whatever this thing is. I notice that it's arising. Okay? Now notice what it's doing to your posture. So that emotion, take the posture of that emotion for just a moment. So for me, it's this, because I'm an introvert. I want to back away from everybody, right? So just take the posture of that emotion. Notice if it's pleasant, unpleasant, or unsure. Good. Okay. Find the body part with one hand where that emotion takes up residence. Put the other hand on a place that is not affected by that emotion. Notice your posture, and if it's not in upright equanimity, use a nice full in-breath to come back upright. Now, the feeling may still be there. It may not. It may have transformed into something else. It may have gone away. But notice that you didn't blame anybody. You didn't physically act it out. You didn't do anything to make it worse. You just noticed that it was coming up, noticed what it did to your posture, noticed where it was in your body, and came back up to upright. This entire sequence takes about 10 seconds. Please take this up as a habit. Okay? It will, especially on the little stuff, it will help you to back down from things that you may need to then go undo later. So one of the things, the study of the four foundations of mindfulness, and especially this third step right here, is that the third foundation of mindfulness is the entry into regretville if we don't pay attention to this, because these emotions can really get out of hand really quickly. So this isn't so much in the third foundation of mindfulness about doing stuff. It's about stopping so that we don't have to undo things later on, so that we don't have to undo, apologize, regrets, etc., etc. This is the antidote to having these emotions just completely run away with us, and then it's suffering and it's hell. So to notice, if you're going to have to put a label on it, don't make it you. Make it that you notice. And then the last part that the Buddha recommended about the third foundation of mindfulness is to notice when it fades and notice when it's gone. Because if we subscribe to the I am that model, then what we tend to do is become permanent around that. I'm always an introvert. He's always angry. It's always, and it's frozen, and we don't get to see the change. So it's also very important to notice, I notice the anger is fading. I notice that even though I have this label of an introvert, I'm not anxious about being with this many people for this long today. I notice. So not only do we notice that it arises, but we notice when it fades. I noticed he's not angry right now. He's very sad because he lost a family member. We can notice these changes. And in the change, compassion has a chance to come forward then, in the change. It doesn't mean you instantly have to love the person or even yourself, but noticing the change gets that opening to another way of relating. So to notice when you're not that anymore is also an important thing to do. So one more time, let's just try this. Pick a different emotion on the list. Notice if it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Take on that emotion for a moment. Take the posture of that. Find the body part most affected by that. A body part that is not affected by that. Notice what's happening to your posture. And using the buoyancy of an in-breath, bring yourself back to upright. For the remaining few moments of this section on the third foundation of mindfulness, just take the list of 108 and gently just skip through the list and say, I notice this arising. And notice how different that feels than to say, I am that. So if you want to try that, if you want to try both of them, you could try saying, I am wrathful. And then say, wrath arises. And notice the difference of how those feel even in your body. As you have probably already discovered, if we say the emotion arises, we then have a choice about whether we give in to it or not. If we have decided that we are already 100% of that emotion, we have no choice. But if we can notice it coming up and say, oh, there it is, then we have a choice. And I'll tell you what one of my biggest ones is that I get to practice 3 or 4 times a week. The person who gets in the line at the grocery store at the 15 or items less express line with 29 items. And every time I say, irritation arises. And then I stand there in the line and do standing meditation instead of allowing that. I just stand there and I just follow my breath until it's my turn to have my items checked. So we can do this on little stuff throughout the day. There it is. Yeah, well, there it is, and I don't have to be that. I can sit here and breathe instead. We have a choice if we don't think it's us. If we just see it, there it is, arise. So here we are, the fourth foundation of mindfulness. We have arrived at the end or the beginning. And here's where we get to have the story, finally. Finally, we get to tell the whole story, except there's a catch. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is not to get to indulge in the story and wallow in it. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is to analyze how we always end up here, how we always end up in whatever 5 of those 108 kleshas or our favorites on that list. How do we always arrive in this? So this, traditionally in Buddhism, the fourth foundation of mindfulness is called objects of mind. And that might sound a little odd. It's like, well, what are the objects if what we're really doing is analyzing the story? Well, the objects are, in Buddhism, are the things that get us into the story. And the most obvious objects are the senses. Okay, so think about the senses as an object for a moment. And what we can do is say, when I hear, when I see, those are the two big ones, okay, then I get angry or anger arises. Okay, so it's the fourth foundation of mindfulness is an in-depth analysis of how we got to this story that we cling to and that makes suffering around those 108 that then we think is pleasant or unpleasant and affects our posture and our breathing. You see how this the whole list works now? Okay, so let's go back and let's see what the habit pattern is, what the pattern is in my situation of I'm in the express line at the grocery store. Okay, so here I go. When I see somebody in the express line at the grocery store with more than the allowed number of items, irritation arises. There we go. That's the story. Okay, it's a pretty simple one, but wars get started over less. So let's just stay with that one, you know, for a minute. Okay, So then I notice that the object here is when I see 29 items, right? Well, if I do that, when I see 29 items, irritation arises. What's the obvious fix to this suffering?
Don't count.
Don't count. Right, exactly. So what did I do? I took up a practice of not counting other people's grocery items. Right. It's I won't say it's always that easy, but many times it is. Many times it's that easy to notice what's happening and then just stop doing it. Just stop doing it. It's so interesting how this happens. So the fourth foundation of mindfulness is being with and being willing to look at our habit of how we get here. And it could be with anything, you know. So I don't have another example for you because you all have hundreds like I do, okay? When Uncle George walks through the door, X arises. You know, this is what is this? And this is where meditation and yoga can both be helpful, because we cannot do this analysis when we're multitasking. We cannot do this analysis when we've got our phone in our hand. We need to give ourselves the gift of some quiet space to be able to say, if we're going to start at the fourth foundation, which is good, but we have to do it in a non-reactive place. In other words, in a place where we're not going to wallow in the story, we're going to examine the story and see how it is that we got there. So we come to places like this. We create spaces for ourselves at home. We don't fill up our to-do list. We don't fill up our calendar, so that we have some space to analyze this chain of all of these four foundations of mindfulness, of how we get into these stories that causes suffering. So let me go back to the grocery example. Who was suffering in that situation, me or the person with the 29 items? Me, for sure. I don't know their story, okay? But I can tell you about a time that I went through the line with more items than was allowed. It was the morning that they brought my mom home from the hospital to go into hospice in her home, and I was her sole hospice care. There was a hospice care team, but I was the 24-hour person. And the ambulance with her dying body was going to arrive, and I needed to get some stuff at the grocery store because I was going to be in the house for the next few days until she died. And all of a sudden, there were more items than allowed in the express line in my basket, and I had to get home. And I don't know that person in front of me every time that has more items than I do, I don't know that they're not in the same boat. Okay, I don't know that. Okay, and nobody chewed me out when I had more items. Everybody was very kind, and the checker was very kind, and she could probably see from my face that I was in distress, and nobody made it worse. Nobody made it worse. So I stopped counting because it made it worse. It did. And I was the one suffering. So the idea in the fourth foundation of mindfulness is, what is the object, or what is the thing? Object is a funny word, but it has a specific meaning in Buddhism. But what is it that sets me off? That might be the way to think about it. What is it that sets me off on this habitual? So let me pick a one that has happened to all of us. When I see somebody cut me off on the freeway, this is a really good one. Road rage. We could all have stories about this, right? When I see somebody cut me off, irritation arises, or worse, right? I grip the wheel. Right? I curse. Who's suffering? Right? Not the driver in front of us, right? Not the person who cut us off, right? Okay. It's peace never depends on the other person. Okay? Now, all of us who have ever driven a vehicle have probably been in a city we don't know, and our exit all of a sudden is right there, and we cut somebody off. Why not go, if you have to make a story, why not make that story, that they're lost? How about this? Blanche Hartman, the late abbess of San Francisco Zen Center, had this wonderful practice she called siren practice, which you got to practice a lot if you lived at the temple in downtown San Francisco, because in the middle of Zazen, bunches of sirens would go off. And she would say, oh, your choice is, you could say, oh, that siren just entered. I was having the perfect meditation until that siren went off. She said you could say that, or you could say, may they arrive in time. Your choice. So this fourth foundation is the analysis of how we put ourselves in hell, frankly. That's what it is how do we cause this suffering? And it tends to be habitual. We tend to do this over and over and over again. And not only do we not see it, we think that's the right way to be. Remember 6 hours ago when this started and I said we get into an off-balance position and then I wonder why all of you are tilted? Yeah. So we examine our story. How is it that we got there? And then we can take it back down and say, all right, this is the story. This emotion arises, not I am that. This emotion arises. It's unpleasant. It's having this effect on my posture. I can't breathe. Deep breath. And you can learn to do it just about that fast. Just about that fast. This is a very worthwhile habit to begin to develop, is to say, ah, there it is again. There it is. Every time I see this, this arises. It does this to my body, and I'm going to choose to not go there. This is especially hard with family members. I will just put that out there. They tend to be graduate level practice sometimes. So start on the easy stuff, like the driver who cuts you off. So what are some immediate alternatives? And I'm just going to mention two this afternoon that are both very important. When we notice the start of this habit pattern, I might suggest to you that generosity and gratitude are immediate antidotes to these stories. A habit of generosity that I took up when I lived at Green Gulch Farm was every time I noticed even just a little bit of anger arising, I would go to the dish room and wash the dishes. And one of two things happened by the time I had the dishes cleared. Either I couldn't remember what I was angry about, or I got some perspective from having done an act of generosity for the community and focusing on that. I got some perspective on what the problem was that I brought in to the room. So as counterintuitive as it is, and we often, when we're clenched by one of those clashes, we don't think of generosity, but even if it's generous to ourselves, and I would say probably the dishes were most generous to me because it gave me some space, if we can just stop and do something generous, even a little bit, that will break the chain a little bit. And when we're generous, we tend to be upright. We tend to be breathing. Our posture tends to be, you know, confident. And we can move forward in an upright manner. So generosity is a wonderful thing to bring forward. The other one is gratitude. And this is hard sometimes to express gratitude for somebody who's being a jerk. And we have a whole story about how they're always a jerk and we've put the label on them and we've frozen the label on them. But I would say, I want to stretch a little bit on that and say that even people who, as soon as you see them, you just go, ah! And the whole story starts, is that if nothing else, you can express gratitude for having them show you how you don't want to be in the world. how you don't want to show up. If they have a habit pattern that really irritates you, you can express some gratitude for them being such a clear teacher about how you don't want to be in the world. Even then, you can do that. So some gratitude, or some gratitude that, you know, I could express to the person with the too many items would be some gratitude for everyone around them who is giving them the space to cheat, as some people might call it. But since we don't know what their story is, we're going to give them their space to have their 29 items and to express gratitude that the checker is moving swiftly so that person won't actually hold up the... Anyway, find something to be grateful for. And that helps to soften that habit pattern. I want to end this part with the Four Foundations with a section, paragraph from Dale Wright's book on the perfections in Buddhism, the first of which is generosity. And I love what he says here. He says, to give and be generous is momentarily to be free of ourselves. In other words, to be free of our story, to be free of our escalation of that habit pattern. To give and be generous is momentarily to be free of ourselves, free of greed and attachments, resentments and hatreds, habitual and isolating acts of self-protection. A generous person is on that occasion not a prisoner of self-imposed boundaries and insecurities. In other words, not a prisoner of the story. This momentary experience is exhilarating because it entails an expansion out beyond the impulsive anxieties of self-protection. In this sense, the practices of generosity are among the practices of freedom, and they carry with them all the joy and pleasure that are associated with liberation. So, a simple act of generosity, either to ourselves or to someone else, frees us from that chain, frees us from that habitual action, allows us to back off down the four foundations of mindfulness, past pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, past an emotion, back into our body, and to come home to the wisdom of the body, the space that is created by our breath, and a stance of equanimity that does not depend on another person.